A cartoon appeared in a Washington rag called The Gab and Joust, showing Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln throwing back glasses of champagne as the boy, with tiny X's for his eyes, climbed into an open grave, inquiring, "Father, a glass before I go?"
In The Rudderless Ship When Presidents Flounder by Maureen H. Hedges.
The noise, the revelry, the manic drunken laughter late into the night, the little boy lying there with his high fever, feeling utterly alone, fighting to stave off the presence of the hooded figure near the door.
Spicer opposite.
Father, a glass before I go? Father, a glass before I go? Father, a glass before I go?
Hedges opposite.
The doctor assured Lincoln that Willie would recover.
Chase opposite, account of Joshua Freewell.
Lincoln heeded the doctor's advice.
Stragner opposite.
Lincoln failed to overrule the doctor.
Spicer opposite.
Electing not to err on the side of caution, the president advised that the party proceed.
Hedges opposite.
The party went ahead with the president's blessing, the little boy suffering horribly upstairs.
Chase opposite, account of Joshua Freewell. '74.
Outside, an owl shrieked. I became aware of the smell rising up off our suit. Linen, sweat, barley. I had thought not to come here again, thus thought Mr. Lincoln. Yet here I am. One last look, and dropped into a country squat before the sick box. His little face again, little hands. Here they are. Ever will be, just so. No smile, ever again. The mouth a tight line. He does not, no, look like he is sleeping. He was an open-mouthed sleeper, and many expressions would play across his face as he dreamed, and he would sometimes mumble a few silly words. If there ever really was a Lazarus, there should be nothing preventing the conditions that pertained at that time to pertain here and now. Then it was quite something. Mr. Lincoln tried to get the sick form to rise. By making his mind quiet and then opening it up to whatever might exist that he did not know about, that might be able to make the sick form rise. Feeling foolish, not truly believing such a thing was even still. It is a vast world, and anything might happen. He stared down at the sick form, at one finger upon one hand, waiting for the slightest, "Please, please, please." But no. That is superstition. Will not do. Come around, sir, to good sense. I was in error when I saw him as fixed and stable, and thought I would have him forever. He was never fixed, nor stable, but always just a passing, temporary energy burst. I had reason to know this. Had he not looked this way at birth, that way at 4, another way at 7, been made entirely anew at 9? He had never stayed the same, even instant to instant. He came out of nothingness, took form, was loved, was always bound to return to nothingness. Only I did not think it would be so soon, or that he would precede us. Two passing temporarinesses developed feelings for one another. Two puffs of smoke, became mutually fond. I mistook him for a solidity, and now must pay. I am not stable, and Mary not stable, and the very buildings and monuments here not stable, and the greater city not stable, and the wide world not stable. All alter, are altering, in every instant. Are you comforted? No. It is time to go. So distracted was I by the intensity of Mr. Lincoln's musings that I had entirely forgotten my purpose, but recalled it now. Stay, I thought. It is imperative that you stay. Let Manders go back alone. Sit on the floor now and be comfortable, and we will usher the boy into you. And who knows what positive outcome may result from this reunion, a reunion which both of you so ardently desire. I then supplied the most precise mental images I could conjure of him staying. Sitting, being content to sit, sitting comfortably, finding peace via the process of staying, etc., etc. Time to go, thought Mr. Lincoln, rising up a bit on his haunches in a pre-leaving way. When, toddling along, he went down, I swept him up and kissed away his tears. When none were playing with him in Prester's lot, I came over with an apple and cut it up for all. That did the trick. That, and his natural way. Soon he was bossing and leading. And now I am to leave him, unhelped, in this awful place. You wallow. He is beyond your help. Old Mr. Grassy in Sangamon went to his wife's grave 40 days in a row. At first it seemed admirable, but before long we were joking about him, and his store went to ruin. Therefore resolved. Resolved. We must now. Cause yourself to have such thoughts, however harsh, as will lead you to do what you know to be right. Look. Look down. At him. At it. What is it? Frankly investigate that question. Is it him? It is not. What is it? It is that which used to bear him around, the essential thing, that which was born, that which we loved, is gone, though this was part of what we loved. We loved the way he, the combination of spark and bearer, looked and walked and skipped and laughed and played the clown. This here is the lesser part of that beloved contraption. Absent that spark, this lying here is merely... Think it. Go ahead. Allow yourself to think that word. I would rather not. It is true. It will help. I need not say it to feel it and act upon it. It is not right to make a fetish of the thing. I will go. I am going. I need no further convincing. Say it, though, for truth. Say the word rising up in you. Oh, my little fellow. Absent that spark, this lying here is merely... Say it. Meat. an unfortunate, a most unfortunate conclusion. I tried again, giving it my all. Stay, I beseeched. He is not beyond your help, not at all. You may yet do him much good. Indeed, you may be of more help to him now than you ever were in that previous place. For his eternity hangs in the balance, sir. If he stays, the misery that will overtake him is quite beyond your imagining. So, linger, tarry, do not rush off. Sit a spell. Make yourself at home. Dawdle. And, settling in, be thee content. I implore you. I had thought this helpful. It is not. I need not look upon it again. When I need to look upon Willie, I will do so in my heart, as is proper. There, where he is yet intact and whole. If I could confer with him, I know he would approve, would tell me it is right that I should go, and come back no more. He was such a noble spirit. His heart loved goodness most. So good. Dear little chap, always knew the right thing to do, and would urge me to do it. I will do it now, though it is hard. All gifts are temporary. I unwillingly surrender this one, and thank you for it, God, or world. Whoever it was gave it to me, I humbly thank you, and pray that I did right by him, and may, as I go ahead, continue to do right by him. Love. Love. I know what you are.
75.
We had succeeded in hacking our way nearly through the waist belt with our nails and a sharp stone we had found nearby.
Almost there, I called in to Mr. Volman.
But it was too late.
Mr. Lincoln closed the sick box. My heart sank.
Lifted the box, carried it back to the wall slot, slid it in. All was lost.
And walked out the door.
76.
Into the now hushed crowd.
Which parted meekly to let him through.
Gone? The boy cried out. We had him free now. He pushed out from the wall and, staggering a few steps away, sat on the floor.
Where the tendrils immediately began to take him again.
77.
Come, I said to Mr. Bevins. I alone was insufficient. I think we must both try to stop him.
Reverend, Mr. Bevins said to me, will you join us? Even one additional mind may make the difference. Especially a mind as powerful as yours, said Mr. Volman. Many years ago, I had joined my friends in performing Loque Passion upon an estranged young couple who had snuck into this place after hours. We had, on that occasion, caused the young people to fornicate and become re-engaged. A year or so after that reconciliation, the young husband returned to this place, seeking the sight of that assignation. Curious, we performed Loque Passion again, and found that those causes for dissension which had initially sundered their engagement had, in the fecund climate of marriage, grown and festered, leading, recently, to the self-destruction, by poison, of his young wife. Our interference on that occasion had, it must be said, left blood on our hands. I had vowed there and then never again to participate in that practice. But my affection for the boy, and my sense that my earlier inattention had compromised him, caused me now to renounce that oath and join my friends.
Dashing out of the white stone home, run skimming as fast as we could, the three of us closed rapidly on Mr. Lincoln.
Then leapt.
Into the president.
The crowd swarming around us.
Several bolder individuals, inspired by our example, also made to enter.
By first taking exploratory runs through the president, or brushing glancingly against him, or darting into and then out of him, as a loon might break the surface of a lake to seize a fish.
Mr. Cahoe's outspoken former boilermaker, matching Mr. Lincoln's pace, strolled into him from behind and stayed there, moving identically within him, stride for stride.
"Nothing to it," Cahoe said, his voice gone high-pitched with the audacity of the act.
All were now emboldened.
Soon it became a general movement.
No one wishing to be excluded.
Many individuals encroaching upon one another.
Entering one another.
Becoming multiply conjoined.
Shrinking down as necessary.
So that all might be accommodated.
Mrs. Crawford entered, being groped as usual by Mr. Longstreet.
The stabbed Mr. Boys entered. Andy Thorne entered, Mr. Twistings entered, as did Mr. Durning.
The Negro contingent, having broken free of Lieutenant Stone and his patrol, came therein. Stone and patrol, offended by the notion of proximity to those persons, declined to follow.
The Barons were now therein. Miss Doolittle, Mr. Johannes, Mr. Bark, and Tobin Badger Muller were therein.
Along with many others.
Too many to enumerate.
So many wills, memories, complaints, desires, so much raw life force.
It occurred to us now, as Manders, lantern held high, preceded the president into a grove of trees, that we might harness that mass power to serve our purpose.
What Mr. Volman had been unable to accomplish alone,
perhaps all of us, working as one, might.
And so, as the lantern light fell out aslant before us, I requested that everyone therein all at once exhort Mr. Lincoln to stop.
We would stop him first, and, if successful, endeavor to send him back.
All willingly agreed.
Flattered to be asked to do anything at all, or participate in the slightest thing.
Stop, I thought, and that multitude joined me, each expressing that impulse in his or her own manner.
Pause, cease, self-interrupt.
Desist, halt, discontinue all forward motion, and so on.
What a pleasure. What a pleasure it was being in there, together, united in common purpose, in there together, yet also within one another, thereby receiving glimpses of one another's minds and glimpses also of Mr. Lincoln's mind. How good it felt, doing this together.
We thought.
We all thought.
As one, simultaneously.
One mass mind, united in positive intention.
All selfish concerns of staying, thriving, preserving one's strength, momentarily set aside.
What a refreshment.
To be free of all of that.
We were normally so alone, fighting to stay, afraid to err.
We had not always been so solitary. Why, back in that previous place,
we now recalled,
all instantaneously recollected.
Suddenly, I remembered. The showing up at church, the sending of flowers, the baking of cakes to be brought over by Teddy, the arm around the shoulder, the donning of black, the waiting at the hospital for hours.
Leverworth giving Burmeister a kind word at the lowest moment of the bank scandal. Furbach drawing out his purse to donate generously to Dr. Pearl, for there had been a fire in the West District.
The hand-holding group of us wading into the surf to search for poor drowned Chauncey, the sound of coins falling into the canvas bag crudely labeled Our Poor, a group of us on our knees weeding the churchyard at dusk, the clanking of the huge green soup pot as my deacon and I lugged it out to those wretched women of the evening in the sheep's grove.
The happy mob of us children gathered about a tremendous vat of boiling chocolate, and dear Miss Bent stirring it, making fond noises at us, as if we were kittens.
My God, what a thing! To find oneself thus expanded!
How had we forgotten all of these happy occasions?
To stay, one must deeply and continuously dwell upon one's primary reason for staying, even to the exclusion of all else.
One must be constantly looking for opportunities to tell one's story.
If not permitted to tell it, one must think it and think it.
But this had cost us, we now saw. We had forgotten so much of all else we had been and known.
But now, through this serendipitous mass cohabitation,
we found ourselves like flowers from which placed rocks had just been removed, being restored somewhat to our natural fullness.
As it were.
It felt good.
It did.
Very good.
And seemed to be doing us good as well.
Looking over, I found Mr. Volman suddenly clad, his members shrunk down to normal size. His clothes were, it is true, decidedly scruffy, printer's apron, ink-dotted shoes, mismatched socks, but nevertheless, a miracle.
Becoming aware of Mr. Bevan staring at me, I glanced over and found him no longer a difficult-to-look-at clustering of eyes, noses, hands at all, but a handsome young man of eager and pleasing countenance, two eyes, one nose, two hands, ruddy cheeks, a beautiful head of black hair, in that vicinity so previously overgrown with eyeballs as to make hair a redundancy. An appealing young fellow, in other words, with the proper number of everything.
"Excuse me," the Reverend said somewhat shyly. "May I ask, how do I look?" "Very well," I said, "quite at ease." "Not afraid at all," said Mr. Volman. "Eyebrows at the proper height," I said, "eyes not overly wide." "Hair no longer sticking straight up," said Mr. Volman. "Mouth no longer an O," I said.
And we were not the only beneficiaries of this happy blessing.
For reasons unknown to us, Tim Midden had always gone about dogged by a larger version of himself that was constantly leaning over to whisper discouragement to him. This behemoth was now gone.
Mr. DeCroy and Professor Bloomer had become unconjoined, and no matter how close together they walked, did not rejoin.
Mr. Tadmill, disgraced clerk, who had misfiled an important document, causing the collapse of his firm, and had thereafter been unable to find other employment, and had begun to drink, and lost his home, and saw his wife placed into a sick box due to excessive worry, and their children dispersed to various orphanages in light of his ever-increasing dissipation, usually presented nearly bent to the ground with regret, shaped like one half of a set of parentheses topped with a sad sprig of white hair, quaking all over, moving with extreme caution, terrified of making even the smallest mistake. But now we saw a spry, young, tow-headed fellow just embarking upon a new position, full of high hopes, flower in his lapel.
Mr. Longstreet discontinued his groping, burst into tears, begged Mrs. Crawford's forgiveness.
"It is just that I am lonely, dear girl."
"If you wish, I can tell you the names of some of our Wildwood's flowers."
"It would be a pleasure to hear them."
Verna Blow and her mother Ella, who normally manifested as virtually identical hags, though both had died in childbirth and had therefore never grown old in that previous place, now appeared, each pushing a baby carriage, youthful again, utterly ravishing.
"Poor, multiply raped Litzy became capable of speech. Her first utterance, consisting of words of thanks to Mrs. Hodge for speaking for her during all of those mute and lonely years."
"Mrs. Hodge, dear woman, accepted Litzy's thanks with a dull nod, looking down in wonder at her own newly restored hands and feet."
Those miraculous transformations among us notwithstanding, Mr. Lincoln was not stopping.
"At all.
On the contrary.
Seemed to be walking faster than ever.
Intent on leaving this place as quickly as possible."
"Ah, me," mumbled Verna Blow, whose restored youthful beauty struck me as wonderful, even in that moment of colossal defeat.
78.
I called for the bachelors, who came at once and hovered above, dropping down in their dear and naive mode of attentiveness, tiny graduation caps. As I explained that we were in a desperate situation, and asked them to go forth across the premises and bring back whatever additional help they could enlist. "How exactly would we say it?" inquired Mr. Kane. "We aren't exactly kings of words," said Mr. Fuller. "Tell them that we work to save a boy," Mr. Volman said, "whose only sin is that he is a child, and the architect of this place has, for reasons we cannot know, deemed that to be a child and to love one's life enough to desire to stay here is, in this place, a terrible sin, worthy of the most severe punishment. Tell them we are tired of being nothing and doing nothing and mattering not at all to anyone and living in a state of constant fear," the Reverend said. "Not sure we can remember all that," said Mr. Kane. "Sounds like quite a commitment," said Mr. Fuller. "We'll defer to Mr. Lippert," said Mr. Kane, "as he is senior among us."
Although, in truth, we three were all of the same age, each of us having come to this place in the midst of his 28th year, unloved and unwed, as of yet. I was indeed, technically, the ranking member of our little party, having been here first, and lonely, for near 9 years, at which time I had been joined by Mr. Kane, delivered here by the untimely occasion of an Indian lance piercing him in the buttocks. After which Mr. Kane and I became an inseparable duo for nearly 11 years, at which time that young cub Mr. Fuller, having made an ill-advised drunken leap off a Delaware silo, completed our trio. And it seemed to me, having given it my consideration, that it was not in our best interest to get involved, for this affair had nothing to do with us, and might threaten our very freedom, and burden us with noxious obligations, and constrain us in our endeavor of doing, at all times, exactly what we liked, and might even exert a deleterious effect upon our ability to stay. "Terribly sorry," I shouted down. "We do not wish to, and therefore shall not."
Stanley, Professor Lippert.
The hats the bachelors sent down now were bowlers, black, somber, funereal, as if, for all their habitual levity, they understood the gravity of the moment, and, though they had no intention of lingering, regretted not being more helpful.
But their sadness did not last long.
They sought love, or so they told themselves, and hence must always be in motion. Hopeful, jocular, animated, continually looking and seeking.
Seeking any new arrival, or old arrival overlooked, whose unprecedented loveliness might justify the forfeiture of their prized freedom.
So off they went.
Professor Lippert in the lead, we embarked on a merry chase across the premises.
Jean Rascal Kane.
Flying low over hills and paths, proceeding at speed through sick houses and sheds and trees, and even a deer of that other realm.
Jack Malarkey Fuller.
Who, startled at our nearly simultaneous entry and exit, reared up, as if bee-stung.
79.
In discouragement, individuals began to abandon Mr. Lincoln,
bundling themselves into fetal balls and tumbling out,
vaulting out with gymnastic flair,
or simply slowing slightly, allowing the president to walk out of them.
Each fell prostrate upon the trail, moaning with disappointment.
It had all been a flim-flam.
A chimera.
Mere wishful thinking.
Finally, passing J.L. Bagg, he lives now forever in the light. Even we three dropped out.
First Bevins, then Volman, then I.
Falling out in sequence along the path, near the Muir Memorial.
A cluster of angels fussing over twin boys in sailor garb who lay side by side on a slab.
Felix and Leroy Muir, perished at sea.
It was not well done. It appeared the angels meant to operate on the young sailors, but were confused as to how to begin.
Also, for some reason, a pair of oars lay upon the operating table.
Only then did we remember the lad, and what he must now be enduring.
And roused ourselves, despite our weariness, and started back.
80.
And though that mass cohabitation had jarred much loose from me, a nagging, hazy mental cloud of details from my life now hung about me. Names, faces, mysterious foyers, the smells of long-ago meals, carpet patterns from I knew not what house, distinctive pieces of cutlery, a toy horse with one ear missing, the realization that my wife's name had been Emily. It had not delivered the essential truth I sought as to why I had been damned. I halted on the trail, lagging behind, desperate to bring that cloud into focus and recall who I had been and what evil I had done, but was not successful in this, and then had to hurry to catch my friends up.
81.
The lad lay collapsed on the floor of the white stone home, cocooned to the neck in a carapace that appeared fully concretized.
The putrid smell of wild onions pervaded that vicinity, progressing in its density toward a different, more sinister odor, for which there is no name.
He lay gazing up at us, dull-eyed, acquiescent.
It was over.
The lad must take his medicine.
We gathered around to say goodbye.
Imagine our surprise then when a woman's voice rang out, offering a parley, suggesting that he would have no objection if we wished to transport the boy back up to the roof, so that he might serve out his infinite interment there.
Mind you, none of this is by our choice, said a bass voice with a slight lisp. We are compelled.
These voices seemed to be emanating from the carapace itself.
Which seemed comprised of people. People like us, like we had been. Former people, somehow shrunken and injected into the very fabric of that structure. Thousands of writhing tiny bodies, none bigger than a mustard seed, twisting minuscule faces up at us.
Who were they? Who had they been? How had they come to be so compelled?
We won't discuss that, said the woman's voice. We'll not discuss that. Mistakes were made, said the bass voice.
My advice, said a third and British voice, do not massacre an entire regiment of your enemy. Never conspire with your lover to dispose of a living baby, said the bass lisper.
Rather than murdering your loved one with poison, resolve to endure him, said the woman.
Sexual congress with children is not permitted, said the voice of an old man from Vermont, judging by his accent.
As each spoke, the associated face bloomed up out of the carapace for the briefest of instants, bearing upon it a look of agony and aggrievement.
We had seen many strange things here.
But this was the strangest yet.
Are you in hell? Asked the Reverend. Not the worst one, said the British fellow. Are not compelled to bash our skulls against a series of clustered screwdrivers, at least, said the woman. Are not being sodomized by a flaming bull, said the bass lisper.
Whatever my sin, it must, I felt, I prayed, be small compared to the sins of these. And yet, I was of their ilk, was I not? When I went, it seemed it would be to join them. As I had many times preached, our Lord is a fearsome Lord and mysterious and will not be predicted, but judges as he sees fit. And we are but as lambs to him, whom he regards with neither affection nor malice. Some go to the slaughter, while others are released to the meadow by his whim. According to his standard, we are too lowly to discern. It is only for us to accept his judgment and our punishment. But as applied to me, this teaching did not satisfy. And oh, I was sick, sick at heart.
What will it be, then, said the Brit, in here or on the roof?
All eyes turned to the boy,
who blinked twice, but said nothing.
Perhaps, Mr. Bevan said, perhaps you could make an exception. And from the carapace burst forth the sound of bitter laughter. "He is a fine child," said Mr. Volman, "a fine child with many..." "We have done this to many, many fine children before," said the woman. "Rules are rules," said the Brit. "But why, may I ask," said Mr. Bevins, "should there be different rules for children than for the rest of us? It does not seem fair." From the carapace came outraged rebukes in diverse languages, many of which were utterly strange to us. "Please do not speak to us of fairness," the woman said. "Fairness, bah," said the Vermonter. "Did I murder Elmer?" the woman said. "You did," said the Brit. "I did," said the woman. "Was I born with just those predispositions and desires that would lead me, after my whole preceding life, during which I had killed exactly no one, to do just that thing?" "I was." "Was that my doing? Was that fair? Did I ask to be born licentious, greedy, slightly misanthropic, and to find Elmer so irritating? I did not, but there I was." "And here you are," said the Brit. "Here I am, quite right," she said. "And here I am," said the Vermonter. "Did I ask to be born with a desire to have sex with children? I don't remember doing so there in my mother's womb. Did I fight that urge? Mightily. Well, somewhat mightily as I could. As mightily as someone could who had been born with that particular affliction, in that particular measure. Upon leaving that previous place, did I attempt to make that case to those who arraigned me?" "I expect that you did," the woman said. "Of course I did," the Vermonter said indignantly. "And how did they respond?" asked the Brit. "Not very well," the Vermonter said. "We have had a great deal of time to think upon these matters," said the woman. "Rather too much," said the Vermonter. "Listen," the bass whisper intoned. "At the time Marie and I did away with that baby, we felt ourselves to be working in the service of good. Honestly, we loved one another. The baby was not quite right, was an impediment to our love. His stunted development impeded the natural expression of our love. We could not travel, could not dine out, were rarely given the slightest degree of privacy, and so it seemed to us at that time that to remove the negative influence that was that baby, by dropping him into Furnace Creek, would free us up to be more loving and be more fully in the world and would relieve him of the suffering entailed in being forevermore not quite right. Would, that is, free him up from his suffering as well, and maximize the total happiness." "It seemed that way to you," the Brit said. "It did, it truly did," the bass whisper said. "Does it seem that way to you now?" the woman asked. "Less so," the bass whisper said sadly. "Then your punishment is having the desired effect," the woman said.
"We were as we were," the bass whisper barked. "How could we have been otherwise? Or being that way, have done otherwise? We were that way at that time, and had been led to that place, not by any innate evil in ourselves, but by the state of our cognition and our experience up until that moment. By fate, by destiny," said the Vermonter. "By the fact that time runs in only one direction, and we are born along by it, influenced precisely as we are to do just the things that we do," the bass whisper said. "And then are cruelly punished for it," said the woman. "Our regiment was being badly caught up by the Baluchis," the Brit said. "But then the tide turned, and the mess of them surrendered to us with a white flag, and, well, down into the ditch they went. And the men fired upon my command, none of them, unhappily, mind you. And we threw in their white flag on top of the savages and covered them up. How could I have done otherwise? With time flowing in only one direction, and myself made just as I was, with my short temper and my notions of manhood and honor, my schoolboy history of being beaten to within an inch of my life by three older brothers, that rifle feeling so beautiful in my hands and our enemies appearing so loathsome. How are any of us to do other than that which we at that time actually do?" "And did that argument persuade?" the woman said. "You know very well, you tart, that it did not," the Brit said, "for here I am." "Here we all are," said the Vermonter. "And ever shall be," said the Brit. "Nothing to be done about it," said the bass whisper. "Nothing ever to have been done about it," said the woman.
Glancing over, I saw a look pass over the Reverend's face, a flicker of resolve or defiance.
To be grouped with these? Accepting one's sin so passively, even proudly, with no trace of repentance? I could not bear it. Must I even now be beyond all hope? Perhaps I thought, this is faith. To believe our God, ever receptive to the smallest good intention.
Enough, the Vermonter said. Down to business, said the woman. We have wasted too much effort on this one already. The previous one, said the Brit, the girl, much more amenable. Wonderful child, said the woman, completely passive. Never gave us a bit of trouble, said the Brit. Had our way with her, just as pretty as you please, the bass lisper said. Then again, she did not have all this help, said the Vermonter. True, the Brit said. No one helped her a single bit. Young man, the woman said, is it to be here or on the roof?
The lad was silent.
On the roof, the Reverend said, if you please. Very well, said the woman. The carapace fell away at once, and the boy was free.
If I might request the honor of carrying him up there, the Reverend said. Certainly, the woman said.
I reached down, picked the boy up, ran. Out of the crypt and into the night. Ran skimmed like the wind, toward the only place that now held the slightest hope of affording him refuge.
82.
Joyful, joyful, an exceedingly bold stroke.
Bastard! The woman cried out wearily.
Mr. Volman and I ran skimmed out of the Whitestone home in pursuit of the Reverend.
A low wave burst out behind us, a moving knee-high wall comprised of whatever substance the demonic beings happened to be inhabiting in that instant. Grass, dirt, headstone, statue, bench.
Which passed us now.
Like children in the surf, we were lifted, then set down again.
And overtook the Reverend.
Who, slapped and harangued by the matter blur that plashed up all about him, broke down the small hill near the gardener's shed.
The chapel now coming into sight, we suddenly understood his intention.
The demonic beings split into two divisions, as it were, coming up fast on either side of the Reverend, then performed a crossing maneuver at knee level, tripping him up.
As he fell to protect the boy, he instinctively rolled onto his back so as to absorb the brunt of the impact.
And they had him.
Had them. They sought the boy, but, seeking the boy, pinioned the Reverend as well.
In their frenzy, it appeared they were no longer capable of, or interested in, distinguishing between Reverend and lad.
By the time we reached the Reverend and the boy, the two were bundled tightly together within a rapidly solidifying new carapace.
The Reverend's terrible cries sounding from within.
They have me, he shouted. They have even me. I must go. Good God, mustn't I, or be trapped like this forever? Go, yes, by all means, save yourself, dear friend, I shouted. Go! But I don't want to, he shouted. I am afraid. The choked, garbled quality of his voice told us that the carapace had reached his mouth, and then it seemed it had penetrated even into his brain and was making him delirious. That palace, he shouted at the very end, that dreadful diamond palace.
Then from inside the carapace came the familiar yet always bone-chilling fire sound associated with the matter-light blooming phenomenon.
And the Reverend was gone.
The Reverend's departure creating a temporary vacuity within the carapace.
Mr. Volman gave the thing a tremendous kick and caved it in.
As we fell enraged upon it, digging and clawing, I could feel the demonic beings within looking askance at us, repulsed by our ferocity, a revived human proclivity for hatred-inspired action. Mr. Bevins drove one arm in up to the elbow. From the other side, I was able to puncture the carapace with a long bow, and situating myself beneath that bow, drove up with my knees, and the carapace split open, and Mr. Bevins was able to get his two arms fully inside. Letting out a shout of exertion, he began to pull, and soon, like a foal newly born, as wet as untidy, the lad tumbled out. and for a second we were able to clearly observe, inside the ruptured carapace, the imprint of the Reverend's face, which had not, I am happy to say, in those final instants, reverted back to the face we had so long associated with him. Badly frightened, eyebrows high, the mouth a perfect O of terror, but rather, his countenance now conveyed a sense of tentative hopefulness, as if he were going into that unknown place content that he had, at any rate, while in this place, done all that he could.
Mr. Volman snatched up the boy and dashed away. The demonic beings flowing out of the remains of the carapace into the earth gave chase. Soon, from below, Mr. Volman's ankles were cuffed, and he tumbled to his knees, and the demonic beings, forming again into tendrils, shot rapidly up his legs and torso and began pioneering out onto his arms. I raced over, plucked the boy away, dashed off, and within seconds was myself overrun.
I leapt to my feet, raced over, plucked the lad away from Mr. Bevins, dashed off toward the chapel, and just before I was again overrun, managed to fall forward through the northernmost sidewall. "I know this place," the lad mumbled. "I expect you do," I said. "We all know it. For many of us, the chapel had served as our portal, our place of disembarkation, the last place we had ever been taken seriously."
The earth around the chapel began to roil. "Even here," I said, "outside this most holy place, holy, unholy, all the same to us," said the Brit. "Have a job to do," said the Vermonter. "Are compelled," said the woman. "Go in, send him out," said the Brit. "You merely delay," said the Vermonter. "We are gathering our strength," said the Brit. "Shall be in shortly," said the woman. "With a vengeance," said the Vermonter. "Send him out," snapped the Lisper.
Mr. Bevins had just stepped in through the wall when, from the darkness at the front of the chapel, a pronounced manly throat clearing told us we were not alone. Mr. Lincoln sat in the front row of chairs, where he must have sat during the previous day's service.
83.
Tom, as we neared front gate, Prez, catching sight of chapel, said he thought he might go over and sit in that quiet place a bit if I did not mind, and confided in me that he felt his boy was still here, with him, and could not shake that feeling. But perhaps a few minutes sitting silent in that place of prayer might do the trick. Declined my offer of lantern, saying he would not need it, for he saw pretty good in the dark, and always had, and went off through that very space only yesterday, filled with the many hundreds standing on the lawn, in the drizzle, in their black coats and upraised umbrellas, and the sounds of the sad organ from within. And I returned to guardhouse, which is where I am now writing this. While outside his poor little horse's eager hoofs sound against the cobblestone, as if his master's proximity causing him to do a stationary horse dance, preparatory to long ride home. Prez in chapel yet.
84.
The stained glass windows responded dully, but substantially, to the dim moonlight shining through them,
suffusing all with a bluish tint.
All but the first few rows of chairs had been removed since the previous day's service, and these were somewhat disordered.
Mr. Lincoln sat facing forward, legs thrown out before him, hands clasped in his lap, head lowered. For a moment, I thought he might be sleeping. But then, as if intuiting our entry, he roused himself and looked around.
Curious individuals from across the premises were pouring in through the chapel walls like water through a bad mud dam. "Go in," I said to the lad.
The boy blinked twice, went in.
By making to sit in his father's lap.
As he must often have done in that previous place.
Seated, one inside the other now. They occupied the same physical space. The child, a contained version of the man.
85.
Father, here I am. What should I... If you tell me to go, I will. If you tell me to stay, I will. I wait upon your advice, sir. I listened for father's reply. The moonlight swelled. All became more blue-ish. Father's mind was blank. Blank, blank, blank. And then? I cannot believe all of this is actually. He began remembering, reviewing certain things about me, concerning my illness. What was the name of that woman whose daughter was struck by lightning in Ponce's hayfield? Just before walking through, the two of them had been talking about peaches, the different varieties of peaches, which kind each preferred. For nights after, they found her wandering Ponce's, mumbling about peaches, searching for that juncture of the conversation at which she might jump the breach of time and go back, push the girl aside, take the fatal bolt herself. She could not accept that it had happened, but must go over it and over it. Now I understand. That afternoon, he brought in 5 rocks on a tray, meant to try to find the scientific name of each. The rocks are on that tray yet, in the hallway windowsill near his room. I believe I shall never be able to move them. Toward dusk, I found him sitting on the stairs, tray on his knees. "Well, I don't feel so good today," he said. I put my hand on his head, burning.
86. The fever, which had been diagnosed as a cold, developed into typhoid. Leech upset.
Typhoid works slowly and cruelly over a period of weeks, depriving the victim of digestive function, perforating the bowels, causing hemorrhaging and peritonitis.
Epstein upset.
The debilitating symptoms of his illness took their toll. High fever, diarrhea, painful cramps, internal hemorrhage, vomiting, profound exhaustion. Delirium.
Goodwin upset.
Paregoric may ease the racking abdominal pain. Delirium may take the child into a haven of sweet dreams, or it may deliver him into a labyrinth of nightmares.
Epstein upset.
The patient was wandering of mind and did not recognize the distracted, loving face of the tall man who bent over him.
Cunhart and Cunhart upset.
The president would come in from his work for the country and pace about the room, head in his hands at the agonized moans his poor boy was making.
Flag upset.
Kind little words, which are of the same blood as great and holy deeds, flowed from his lips constantly.
In Lincoln as I Knew Him by Harold Holzer, account of Elizabeth Todd Grimsley.
Lincoln had the tenderest heart for anyone in distress, whether man, beast, or bird.
Holzer, Ibid, account of Joshua Fry Speed.
He had a great kindness of heart. His mind was full of tender sensibilities. He was extremely humane.
Wilson and Davis, opposite, account of Leonard Sweat.
I never in my life associated with a man who seemed so ready to serve another.
Holzer, opposite, account of John H. Littlefield.
He was certainly a very poor hater.
In Abraham Lincoln, The True Story of a Great Life, by William H. Herndon and Jesse W. Weick.
How that beloved boy's sufferings must have tormented one so naturally sympathetic.
Flag opposite.
Willie Lincoln thrashed and moaned, and nothing at all could be done.
Hilliard opposite account of D. Strumport, Butler.
The burning cheeks, the frantically roving eyes, the low moans of despair seemed to signal a great torment within and a corresponding desire to escape it and be himself again, a happy little fellow.
Honer opposite.
In his thrashing, young Willie kicked off the gold and purple bedspread. It lay in a heap on the floor.
Sternlet opposite.
The yellow trimmings, gold tassels and fringes did not relieve the gloominess of the regal decor, but instead reminded visitors that darkness and death came even to princes.
Epstein opposite.
Now the eyes went dim. All that restless motion came to a halt. That stillness seemed the most terrifying thing of all. He was on his own now. None could help or hinder him on the profound journey which, it seemed, had now begun.
Honer opposite.
The death dew gathered on his brow.
Keckley opposite.
In the room of death, just before the cessation of breath, time seems to stop entirely.
Sternlet opposite.
The president could only stand and watch, eyes wide, having no power at all in this new arrived and brutal realm.
Honer opposite. '87.
Wait, the lad said. He sat there, within his father, a look of consternation on his little face, seeming more upset than comforted by whatever he was hearing. Come out, I ordered.
I don't understand, he said.
Come out at once, I said.
'88.
The body was embalmed on February 22nd by Drs. Brown and Alexander, who were assisted by Dr. Wood.
In Lincoln Lore, Bulletin of the Lincoln Life Foundation, number 1511, January 1964.
Neither Brown nor Alexander personally embalmed Willie. That job fell to their master embalmer, Henry P. Cattell.
In Stealing Lincoln's Body by Thomas J. Crawwell.
Frank T. Sands was the chief undertaker. Perhaps it was he who suggested the precaution of covering the breast of the corpse with the green and white blossoms of the mignonette, Reseda odorata, known for its overpoweringly sweet fragrance.
Epstein opposite.
The method of Saignée of Paris was used.
Lincoln Lore opposite.
Saignée had pioneered the innovative use of zinc chloride.
In Pausing Death, 19th Century Embalming and the Cult of Immortality, by Stephen Wedge and Emily Wedge.
5 quarts of a 20% solution of zinc chloride injected through the popliteal artery not only preserved a body for a minimum of 2 years, but also wrought a wondrous transformation, giving the body the appearance of luminous white marble.
Crawwell opposite.
Extravagant claims were made of the Saignée process, stating that the remains became a shell in effigy, a sculpture.
Lincoln Lore opposite.
A trestle table was assembled in place for the procedure. The carpets in the green room were rolled back and the flooring protected by use of a large square of tenting fabric.
In The Doctor's Assistant, Memoirs of D. Root by Donovan G. Root, M.D.
The procedure did not require draining the body of the blood. The boy was undressed, and an incision made in the left thigh. The zinc chloride was pumped in using a small diameter metal pump. No unusual difficulties were encountered. The entry point required a small suture, and the boy was redressed.
Wedge and Wedge opposite.
The mother being distraught, the burial clothes had been selected by the father and sent down to us in an oversized hat box.
Route opposite.